It's a very significant sentence, so we're comfortable with his decision.
Another Alaska militia member gets a quarter century in prison. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 8th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, two new government investigations will look at Shell's grounding incident. The company also has questions.
I think it's fair to say we're shaking our own heads a bit. We have a lot of experience working in the Arctic. So why are we getting in our own way?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
Fairbanks militiaman Francis Schaefer Cox is facing 310 months in prison. Federal Judge Robert Bryan handed down the sentence, close to 26 years, in U.S. District Court in Anchorage at noon today, despite pleas of leniency from both Cox and his attorney, Peter Camille. Federal prosecutors had asked the court for a 35-year sentence for Cox. Prosecutor Stephen Scrocky called Cox a, quote, master manipulator and a danger to the community. Scrocky painted a grim picture of the defendant as a man using the facade of a militia to collect grenades and other weapons while compiling a hit list that included judges, federal employees, even former friends.
We agree with the court's sentencing recommendation of 25 years. It's a very significant sentence. So we're comfortable with his decision.
Cox's attorney, Camille, would not comment after leaving the court other than to say that it is likely Cox will appeal the sentence. Judge Bryan announced the sentence after 2.5 hours of court proceedings. Camille argued against increasing the sentence because of the government employee status of some of Cox's intended victims. He also pleaded with the court to consider a post-trial psychological evaluation of his client, who he claimed is a paranoid schizophrenic. He was controlled by paranoia, Camille said, but Scrocky said the court did not put a lot of stock in the report's value.
In our arguments to the court, we pretty much asked the judge to make his own observations about what he saw with respect to Mr. Cox's conduct. And I think he did that in sentencing, that he was able to see the things that he did on the stand compared to what he did on the tape and during the investigation. A lot of things were sort of convenient in terms of his emotional responses, things like that. So I think the court saw that as well.
Cox, for his part, told the court, quote, I put myself here. He sat through the proceedings with a stony face and broke down toward the end, reaching for Kleenex to wipe his eyes as he apologized to his wife, his family, and former friends, some of whom had testified against him at trial. Cox claimed he was driven by fear and paranoia and that had no actual intention of killing anyone. I was trying to wake up from a nightmare I couldn't get away from, he said. Cox was convicted last summer on 9 counts, including conspiracy to murder federal officials and weapons charges. Today, Judge Bryan said he agreed in part with the psychological report, but said it did not excuse Cox's actions. Bryan told the court that Cox is a danger to the public. Another former Alaska Peacekeepers militia member, Lonnie Vernon, received nearly 26 years in prison when he was sentenced yesterday. There will be two federal investigations of what went wrong with the Kulluk, the 266-foot Shell drilling rig that went adrift in the Gulf of Alaska and ended up on the rocks off the outer coast of Kodiak Island. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
One of the investigations was ordered by the Interior Department, and a second was ordered by the U.S. Coast Guard's 17th District Commander, Thomas Ostebo, today. He called for a formal marine casualty investigation of the incident, including engine failures, the loss of tow, and the decision to tow the rig south during storm season in the Gulf of Alaska. The investigation could take up to a year, though Ostebo asked to have it completed within 4 months. Coast Guard spokeswoman Lieutenant Veronica Colbath says the investigation will look at Shell, its contractors, and the Coast Guard itself.
All parties, the investigating officer will look at all factors associated with the incident. That could be from the cause of the accident, looking at the full scope of all towing vessels, towing equipment, procedures, and personnel involved.
The probe was recommended by the incident's on-scene coordinator, Captain Paul Mailer. It'll be run by an investigator from New Orleans.
The investigating officer is Commander Joshua McTaggart, and he's with the National Center of Expertise in New Orleans. And he'll be working with investigators from Coast Guard Sector Anchorage who will assist him.
Also involved in that probe will be the National Transportation Safety Board and the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, an agency set up after the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico to separate the enforcement duties of the Interior Department from its oil and gas leasing activities. In a separate but related move, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar promoted Tommy Boudreau to Acting Assistant Secretary for Land and Minerals Management and put him in charge of an assessment of Shell's past drilling season, including, among other things, the Kulik incident, the inability to equip a spill response barge, and the many safety and propulsion issues surrounding the drilling rig Noble Discoverer. Boudreau runs the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in charge of awarding permits for drilling. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith says the company wants answers, too.
And I think it's fair to say we're shaking our own heads a bit. We know we have a commitment to go above and beyond. We've made a huge investment in technology. And as we've talked about over the years, we have a lot of experience working in the Arctic. So why are we getting in our own way? We don't know the complete answer to that yet. But I promise you, no one here is going to rest well until we have a better answer.
Appearing on the public radio call-in show Talk of Alaska, Smith admitted that Shell's performance has not been satisfactory.
These events are something, of course, we take extremely seriously. And while we are relieved that there appears to be no harm to people, no harm to the environment, we're just very sorry that it happened in the first place. Frankly, Alaskans expect better from Shell, and so do we.
Any investigation of the Kulik is likely to focus heavily on the engine failures experienced by the tug Ivik while it was towing it on New Year's Eve. Smith says once that tow line went slack, they were never able to restore complete control.
Right after the Ivik lost power, it's fair to say that we never got a perfect purchase on the Kulik again, or a really good tow line, the way you would in, say, calm water or in port. It really all started, in my mind, when the Ivik lost its ability to propel itself.
Once the crew was lifted from the tossing rig by helicopter, all chance to restore control was gone because there was nobody aboard the rig to secure the tow line. The tug Ivik has four engines, and all four of them failed. The Coast Guard allowed the tug to return to service once new fuel injectors and filters had been installed, and the engines have been fine since. Environmental groups responded to the announcement of the probes by once again calling on the Obama administration to stop granting drilling permits for the Arctic Ocean. Greenpeace said it has delivered 100,000 signatures to the White House demanding an end to offshore Arctic drilling. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The top oil lobbyist in Washington, D.C. says Shell Oil should not be hampered by the grounding of the Kulik. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the American Petroleum Institute says the company should be allowed to move forward with its Arctic Ocean plans this year.
Speaking at API's State of American Energy, President and CEO Jack Girard echoed Shell Oil's comments on the grounding of the Kulik.
The most important thing is to distinguish that the incident was a transportation, a movement situation.
Girard says the incident has nothing to do with oil drilling. The Kulik has been successfully anchored near Kodiak Island. Girard says that federal regulators are closely watching Shell as it drills and moves its fleet of rigs and vessels. So, in his eyes, it's safe for the company to proceed with its Arctic drilling plans this summer.
I think they're not only highly regulated, but they're highly monitored and scrutinized in what they're doing. So I think that clearly needs to move forward.
Girard's comments come on the same day that Interior Secretary Ken Salazar announced an expedited review of Shell's Arctic ambitions. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Sitka residents reflect on the tsunami evacuation last weekend.
Somebody said that we got all the benefits of an emergency without any of the real sorrow of having it come true.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
An Anchorage high school went into lockdown this morning after a student brought a gun to school. Anita Schell is a spokeswoman for the Anchorage Police Department. She says another student saw the gun and reported it to an administrator.
A student showed another student a gun, and school administration was notified, who also alerted the school resource officers. And within about a minute, we had 15 Anchorage police officers in the school, which was put into lockdown for a brief period of time while we searched the school for the subject.
It took police about 60 seconds to respond, Shell says. When officers arrived, they found the student with the gun in a classroom full of other students. They isolated the 16-year-old male student and arrested him within 10 minutes. The gun was a Glock 40 caliber replica BB gun that looks like a real firearm. All guns, including BB guns, are banned from Anchorage schools. Heidi Embley is a spokeswoman for the Anchorage School District. She says safety procedures worked well.
One thing that we did learn from Sandy Hook is that the lockdown procedure, which the Anchorage School District also has in place, is effective when you call it immediately. And that's exactly what happened in this situation.
Embley says school was back in session by 10 a.m. She says the student who reported the gun was key to the safe outcome.
We very much appreciate that a student had the courage to tell an assistant principal, a trusted adult, someone about safety concerns. That's how these things are going to stop happening, is if kids can tell adults about situations. That's how we get a lot of information about potential threats on campus.
The student was taken to McLaughlin Youth Center. School district officials say the student is on emergency suspension and will likely be recommended for expulsion. Law enforcement officers from across the state have spent the past 2 days in a training on the use of deadly force. The workshop comes after two deadly high-profile suspect shootings by Anchorage police officers in 2012. As KSKA's Daisha Eaton reports, the training is focused on science.
An officer responds to a call. The suspect resists. The officer shoots. It's a situation we've heard about too often lately in Anchorage. Anchorage Police Department officials hope a training this week will help officers avoid deadly shootings whenever possible and help them to explain them better when they do happen. Dr. Bill Lewinsky is with the Force Science Institute, a research consulting and training organization focused on human behavior in use of force situations. Lewinsky says he's teaching officers a scientific approach to field work and investigations by looking at something he calls human dynamics, or how human beings react in high-stress, life-threatening encounters.
What we're looking at is, within those dynamics, what's the best way possible to train an officer so the officer makes the most effective decision possible.
Lewinsky says science can help law enforcement officers with decision-making in an emotionally charged situation, and it can help them more clearly look back at what happened after the fact by setting the parameters. He gives this example.
An officer says he saw a person's hand begin to move and fired. And when we look at the reaction time, I'm citing an actual case, the person's hand began to move less than a quarter second before the officer fired. We know from research on perception, visual perception, reaction time, that that officer is then either the fastest person on the face of the earth, or what they're telling us didn't happen.
Such scientific parameters can be helpful in preventing and solving all sorts of cases, Lewinsky says. Officers came from across Alaska, but the majority who attended the training are with the APD. Lieutenant Derek Scher is the president of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Union. He says he helped bring Lewinsky to Anchorage as a response to last year's officer-involved shootings.
So after we had, you know, a number of high-profile use of force, or as we call it, response to resistance issues here in Alaska, including deadly force for us, the Alaska State Troopers, and other law enforcement agencies, I thought it would be a real benefit to bring Dr. Lewinsky and Force Science to Alaska to help people better understand what is happening, and not just the public, our officers, but most importantly, the people that investigate these cases and the prosecutors as well.
On June 9th, an Anchorage police officer shot and killed Shane Tossey, who was brandishing a stick in the Mountain View neighborhood, calling it a deadly weapon. Less than a month later, Harry Smith was shot and killed in South Anchorage by Anchorage police officers after the 59-year-old pointed a BB gun that looked like a real gun at police. The training officers are getting this week is a supplement to on-the-job training, which Scher says has not caught up with science.
Policing has changed a lot over the last 50 years, and it's become much more academic. And I think Dr. Lewinsky is kind of a byproduct of that need. And what Dr. Lewinsky does is he applies scientific standards to testing and research prior to looking at cases. They use time-lapse photography. They'll use a number of test subjects, and they'll evaluate it very closely from, you know, strict scientific standpoints.
Lieutenant Anthony Henry oversees the homicide and robbery departments at the APD. He says he wants the public to know that the APD does not take lightly the use of deadly force. He says he believes the scientific training will help officers make better decisions about and more accurately investigate deadly force incidents.
It's real easy for the public to recognize and understand and have no questions about a shooting that occurs when a suspect produces a gun. It's usually the toy guns, the BB guns, or non-traditional weapons. They create controversy, but they are no less deadly. And that's the thing that sometimes the general public maybe doesn't fully understand. And we got to do as an agency, as a police agency, be better able to explain those events.
Lieutenant Henry says he hopes to bring the full training program to Anchorage for his homicide unit if the funding becomes available. The training this week cost more than $18,000 and was paid for by the Alaska Police Standards Council. It ran Monday and Tuesday and was not open to the public. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
A contaminated site in Nikiski has residents worried for the safety of their groundwater. The Arness Septage site was a dumping ground in the 1980s for more than 4,000 gallons of oil contaminated waste, sludge, and other pollutants. In the decades since, Department of Environmental Conservation staff say the site has not been properly monitored. Peninsula Clarion reporter Brian Smith just published a 6-part series on the site. He says in the late 1980s, the area was cleaned up, but he told APRN's Lori Townsend there are still big questions about whether area groundwater is still affected.
There was a cleanup effort done in 1988, and as part of that cleanup effort, the DEC drilled a groundwater well into the area, and that was to test to see if the bulk of contaminants that were at the site were reaching the groundwater, and if there was a health hazard and things like that. But that groundwater well was actually up gradient of groundwater flow underneath the site, but they didn't know that at the time.
So how real, then, is the potential threat to human health? Have they drilled another well in the right vicinity?
When I talked to DEC employees, specifically a guy named Paul Horwath, who has watched the development of the site, the problem is we don't know the extent to which this may or may not be a threat to human health. So the bottom line is that DEC considers the site by regulation to not have been properly assessed, by how they do things, normally on other sites. And, when you ask them, well, how much contamination is there, what sort of a threat does this pose to the air, the groundwater in the area, they can't give you a really honest, straight answer because they don't know. And several times in the course of my reporting, I came across emails where DEC staff in Kenai would say things like, there's really no other site under our oversight deserving of a completion of a site assessment due to the potential the site has to negatively impact human health through the contamination of groundwater. So Kenai staff knows that it's of high importance.
Brian, you mentioned that they were pushing to drill more test wells, and it seems from what you said about the Kenai DEC staff that there's a recognition that this is a dangerous area. Why haven't they done more? Why haven't they insisted on these test wells?
Yeah, you know, that's sort of the million-dollar question. In the 90s, from the reporting that I have found, the DEC tried several occasions to get some more wells out there, and they went as far to develop estimates and proposals and things like that. And this is where we get into the sort of bulk of the story that relates around a DEC mismanagement, and that mismanagement word is a very hairy word. But one of the Kenai district officers here, a guy named Paul Horwath, what prompted me to look into the site was he, in an online database that DEC keeps of its contaminated sites, he wrote in February of this year that the site was never properly assessed. There was never really enough study of the groundwater. There weren't wells drilled there. You know, there were multiple efforts by local staff to do exactly, you know, what you said, to get more wells out there. But they were, and this is his words, thwarted by politically appointed DEC management.
So, Brian, you have written a six-part series on this investigation. What's next now? Where is DEC in the process of monitoring or doing something about this site?
Yeah, so going forward, what the Arness family is doing with DEC is they're trying to get a lock on the area's groundwater movement, and so they're kind of doing some investigation with some engineers to really determine where the best place might be to do a couple of wells. And I think that's sort of the big question that everybody's asking is, you know, can we get some wells out there to know for sure?
Reporter Brian Smith has many more details on this complicated story in a six-part series that ran in the Peninsula Clarion in late December. You can find a link to those stories on our website, alaskapublic.org. At 12:13 early Saturday morning in Sitka, the tsunami siren blew. Warnings were broadcast throughout Sitka after the 7.5 magnitude earthquake struck right before midnight, and the siren caught many city residents unprepared. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
After the all clear had sounded and Sitkans returned home from higher ground, resident John Straley, an author and the former Alaska Writer Laureate, took his words to Facebook.
Saturday, 2:45 a.m. When we evacuated at midnight, we took our dog, her dog food, of course. I grabbed my computer with my newest novel and revisions on it, but then I grabbed my mandolin, the old Martin guitar, a box of Wheat Thins, and three bottles of champagne. I had no time to think, but what did you grab?
And within minutes, his friends, also awake, also rattled, also fresh home from the evacuation centers or the hillside homes of friends, began to comment. Guitars, cameras, guns, ammo, food, pets, important documents, photos. One person said she brought her knitting bag in case it was going to be a long night. So on Monday morning, we posed Straley's question to people downtown Sitka. What did you grab in the evacuation?
I grabbed clothes for my kids and my daughter's pink bunny and both our computers and left my cell phone charger behind.
So did I, says someone nearby.
And my phone was almost dead. And I couldn't call anybody.
Do either of you have emergency preparedness kits?
Mine's in storage.
She plans on fishing it out now. Here's another.
And I actually slept through the earthquake, but when it was time to evacuate, everyone came to my house. So I woke up to half the town being right outside my house.
If you had to evacuate, what would you take with you? Do you have a kit?
I do not have a kit with me. That would probably be a good idea, but I would probably take a dog and I'm not quite sure. I'm not ready for a tsunami.
Make no mistake about it. On the macro level, the evacuation of Sitka's low-lying areas appeared to be pretty orderly. There were some traffic jams and other things, but by and large, people were calm and bided their time with friends or at the two school buildings opened as temporary shelters. But on the individual level, a lot of people said they felt personally unprepared. And maybe that's good.
People that are more prepared for a disaster are oftentimes the people that have already experienced something where they were unprepared.
Kelly McGuirk is Disaster Services Director for the Red Cross of Alaska. She says for many in the state, it's less about whether they have the supplies and more about whether they can get at them easily.
As people that live in Alaska, a lot of us enjoy doing outdoor activities and have all the gear that we recommend people to put in their kit. The problem being that it's not all in one location. It's kind of scattered around the house or in the shed or garage.
So the Red Cross and other disaster prep experts urge people to put kits together. A kit should include water, non-perishable foods, flashlights, battery-powered radios, extra batteries for that matter, a first aid kit, phone chargers, personal documents, on and on and on. And there are special items you should consider based on your family's needs.
So if there's somebody in the family that has a specific prescription or medication that they need, make sure that you include that in the kit.
And if you're evacuating with pets, remember pet food. So back to John Straley.
I mean, I was very impressed with the preparedness of our whole community. I was less than impressed with my own preparedness. Although the champagne came in handy, I thought.
But in all seriousness, Friday's earthquake might be a bullet dodged, and Saturday morning's evacuation, a good lesson.
Somebody said that we got all the benefits of an emergency without any of the real sorrow of having it come true.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. The Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, close to the airport in downtown Anchorage, offering Wi-Fi, a hot continental breakfast, and a 24-hour airport shuttle. Reservations at 243-3131.
And by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.